Hello and welcome to another episode of the PE Risks Podcast. I am Lauren Harris, a counsel in our Luxembourg Corporate Department, and I'll be your host for this episode. This podcast focuses on antitrust, foreign direct investment, and foreign subsidies with Stavroula Vrina, a partner in our antitrust practice based in our London office, and Jonathan Blandiel, a senior associate in our antitrust practice based in our Brussels office. Over the last few years, the antitrust, foreign direct investment, and foreign subsidies international regulatory landscape has significantly changed for sponsors investing in portfolio companies. This has resulted in higher numbers of buyouts requiring regulatory approval and has increased the amount of data required to be collected on each fund's portfolio companies. Stavroula, in light of this, where would you like to start this discussion today?
Thanks, Lauren, and happy to be here. I suggest starting with merger control and the impact that antitrust is having on M&A transactions. So antitrust is becoming all the more important for transactions over the past few years. And the most recent developments have meant increased legal uncertainty for parties and often heightened deal risk. And more importantly, prolonged timeframes for clearances, both in the EU and the UK. So let's kick off with that.
Interesting. Yeah, let's start with the UK then.
So in the UK, and I won't repeat history, but post-Brexit, the CMA is really claiming a prominent spot in the antitrust world alongside the European Commission. So many large transactions now require parallel clearance by the European Commission and the CMA. And what's most important about that is that often there's diverging outcomes coming out of these reviews. The two regulators may disagree as to whether a transaction should be cleared or not, or even as to what remedies need to be applied for clearance. The CMA has been particularly aggressive, and I think everyone recalls the Microsoft Activision saga a year ago. We expect them to continue to assert their authority, although they did have to walk a lot of what happened with Microsoft Activision back in the end. So this divergence between the EU and the UK is creating further complexity for parties, and parties, especially in larger transactions that are strategic in nature, need to have counsel on board that can navigate that parallel review and craft a strategy that really takes into account the particularities of each regulator. The other thing we're seeing in the UK is increased scrutiny by the CMA, which is our local regulator here, of so-called roll-up acquisitions by PE firms. So essentially serial acquisitions of minority stakes in the same sector. For instance, last year, the CMA formally reviewed two PE roll-up deals that had not been notified to it. And that was in the vet services sector, and imposed considerable divestments in both cases. So just for PE investors, just one to note here, the CMA is imposing significant risk on minority stakes in particular, and parties should be very careful when preparing their internal documents, especially with respect to how they portray the market and the investor's wider acquisition strategy.
Yes, and if I may add, to take enforcement action against roll-up strategies, some antitrust regulators have bolstered the information requirements in their filing forms. For example, the European Commission's revised notification form, the so-called Form CO, now asks questions on whether any of the merging parties have non-controlling shareholdings in competitors exceeding 10%. Providing this information may prove resource intensive and time consuming, so PE investors should be prepared to gather additional information when making merger control filings.
Yeah, that's right. And I think a broader related point, and I know that everyone who's listening to this has probably heard this from their lawyer, is that portfolio companies should really make sure they identify, they collect, and they maintain the types of information that are needed. To be able to, just for themselves and for their sponsors, to assess where regulatory filings, in particular antitrust filings, are required. Because if that information is missing or incorrect, the sponsor may end up missing a filing, which will potentially derail the whole deal timeline and will have an impact on the relationship with the regulators and so on. Final observation, just because it's very recent on the CMA, again, coming back to the theme of minority stake acquisitions. and other types of partnerships, the CMA recently, a few weeks ago, opened formal investigations against three partnerships between technology companies and AI startups. And a lot of these are kind of on the border, and I would say quite far from tipping the thresholds for actually being even considered transactions. So we're talking about minority stakes, non-controlling minority stakes, we're talking about acqui-hires, and so on. So the CMA is looking into these, and the next few months will be very interesting as to where the CMA comes out. Are these even notifiable transactions? So there's a lot of learnings here for everyone, including PE firms, as to how minority acquisitions, minority stake acquisitions, are assessed by the CMA.
Thank you for highlighting that, Savrula. Jonathan, let's turn to the EU now. What developments have caught your attention there?
Thank you, Lauren. As you may imagine, there have been many developments in recent years, but I will highlight two developments that have created significant legal uncertainty and risk for transacting parties, including PE investors. First, transactions that fall below mandatory filing thresholds face increased risk of regulatory review. For example, to address so-called killer acquisitions and preserve dynamic competition, the European Commission adopted a new approach, some kind of revised policy, to Article 22 of the EU merger regulation. This new approach enables the European Commission to review deals that are referred upwards to it by national competition authorities, even if these transactions do not meet the relevant thresholds to trigger an EU or a national merger control filing, and even after these transactions have closed. Now, this revised policy is currently still subject to review by the European Court of Justice, but the European Commission has accepted referrals in several cases and even blocked the famous Illumina Grill merger following an Article 2022 referral. So where the target of a potential investment is an important innovator focused on R&D or has IP or know-how in relation to important new technologies, PE investors should carefully consider whether the transaction is a candidate for referral, because such referral may create potential delays to the deal timetable, but also uncertainty regarding deal completion. The second development I wanted to highlight is the increased scrutiny of inbound investment in the EU. The number of foreign direct investment regimes in Europe have multiplied in recent years, and all EU member states now either have an FDI regime in place or are in the process of creating or implementing one. There's also new proposed EU legislation, which is expected to further increase the number of FDI filings for large deals in the EU by imposing a minimum scope of sectors, sensitive sectors, in which filings will be required in all EU member states. More importantly, the European Commission also added the foreign subsidies regulation to its enforcement toolbox. This regulation introduces a mandatory filing obligation for certain M&A transactions and public procurement bids, and gives the European Commission powers to investigate foreign subsidies and take action if it concludes that they adversely affect the EU's internal market. It also gives the European Commission the power to block such transactions or bids. And importantly, as part of its review, the European Commission requires extensive information on foreign financial contributions received by the merging parties in a three-year period, and covering all manner of support from a non-EU government, including tax breaks, loans, guarantees, you name it. So gathering the necessary information for an FSR filing is burdensome, and potential investors should identify appropriate processes to gather data on their foreign financial contributions now rather than in the middle of deal negotiations.
Completely agree with that, Jonathan. I think the legislation is very broad, right, to begin with, and that's an issue. It's even more of an issue with PE firms, because even though the Commission is kind of claiming, and I think genuinely in some cases trying to apply the FSR regime pragmatically, I'm not sure they yet fully grasp how PE firms and those types of markets really work, and how overlaying that very broad regime to a PE firm is really disruptive and creates a huge admin burden. So I think this is something that the Commission needs to do a lot of work to actually see what it really needs to review to assess whether the FSR criteria are met and whether there's any risk whatsoever without imposing that admin burden on parties. Because just to give you a sense, right, a PE investor under the FSR regime will need to identify and to aggregate all third country financial contributions it received by any portfolio company in which a fund that it manages has a controlling or jointly controlling interest, and financial contributions that it has it received itself. Often it also needs to aggregate third country contributions received by any fund that it manages, including investments by sovereign wealth funds as limited partners. So in the context of PE deals, in addition to that, the case teams at the European Commission often ask very detailed questions also on limited partner rights and commitments. You can get waivers from these disclosure requirements if you explain to the Commission why this is unnecessary or particularly burdensome and disproportionate. But especially in deals with really tight timetables, the amount of time this may take to do during a live deal can be quite disruptive. So as Jonathan said, I think early preparedness is really important. Good relationships with the European Commission and then the Council representing the parties are very important as well. And really using the best advocacy and creative advocacy to explain to the European Commission why extensive information gathering is really not really relevant to their analysis and is not really necessary.
These sound like all very crucial points to keep in mind. But what about developments outside the merger control space?
If you allow me, Sir, I'll maybe go first.
Of course.
What we see is that antitrust enforcers continue to focus on promoting competition in the labor markets. While the U.S. Department of Justice has lost a number of recent criminal prosecutions relating to so-called no-poach and wage-fixing agreements, labor issues do remain a top priority for the Biden administration, and the Federal Trade Commission recently approved a rule that, with limited exceptions, prohibits employers from entering into or imposing existing non-compete clauses with employees. This is not only a development in the United States. Cases are also increasing in Europe, with recent no-poach infringement decisions in France and findings of wage-fixing violations in Poland, as well as numerous ongoing investigations by the European Commission and national competition authorities in Belgium, France, Portugal, but also the UK. Even more recently, the European Commission also issued a policy brief on wage-fixing agreements and no-poach agreements. So this is definitely a development to keep in mind. Businesses therefore need to ensure that they understand wage economics in their industry and make sure that decision-making on hiring, salaries, and non-competes is independent and compliant with the antitrust laws. A more broader point, as sponsors may be exposed to parental liability for potentially significant fines resulting from breaches of antitrust law by their portfolio companies, as well as reputational damage, it's important that portfolio companies have an antitrust compliance policy in place, and that their senior management and employees receive regular antitrust training, including on the topic of competition in labor markets.
Thanks, Jonathan. And let me just put my tech partner hat on for a second. One other important development that is worth sponsors keeping in mind, especially those with companies in the tech sector, is that the tech sector has been getting a lot of regulatory attention in recent years. And in fact, there's new and far-reaching regulation of the tech sector globally. So in addition to antitrust laws, we now have new laws that regulate, similar to other regulated sectors like telecoms, aspects of the tech sector. So the EU, obviously being the front runner with the regulation of tech markets, with the Digital Markets Act, the Digital Services Act, the Data Act, and the upcoming Artificial Intelligence Act, the European Commission is providing a blueprint for regulators globally on how to regulate tech. Usually these types of regulations tend to apply to kind of larger technology firms, so-called gatekeepers and so on, but they can affect smaller companies as well, either benefit or create risks for them. It's good to be aware of this landscape and how exactly the various new regulations interlink with each other. The same trend we're seeing in the UK as well with the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Bill, which we expect to come into force in October of this year. The next trend to watch out for is cloud services and AI, where there's a lot of antitrust regulatory attention being paid at the moment. There's various investigations around the world, and particularly in Europe, into cloud services and competition in cloud services. And now that's kind of coming and converging with the attention on AI and how cloud and AI interact. We're seeing a lot of regulatory attention on that. The CMA very recently, I believe in the beginning of April of this year, issued a report around foundation models. Other regulators, like the French regulators, also looking into similar issues, the US as well. So that one to watch out for.
Thank you, Sivrul and Jonathan. We could probably continue on talking about these developments for hours, but we'll end our conversation there. Thank you both for your insights, and it sounds as if there are indeed significant trends that sponsors need to be aware of and keep in mind going forward. Thank you for highlighting these. It's truly been a pleasure having you both on the podcast. For more information, we ask listeners to reach out via the website, and also we'd like to invite listeners to check out our other episodes, which touch on other key trends in the PE risks landscape.